Baruchim Habaim. It is with very mixed emotions I'm giving tonight's share because my father-in-law, my wife's beloved dad, who I really love, is fighting for his life in New York, not corona-related, but other issues with his brain. He's had some surgeries. Mm-hmm. So I want to dedicate share tonight. I specifically mentioned to Rabbi Andrews that I wanted to give class tonight, and it should be the schus. The merit of our learning should be a refuah for my beloved father-in-law, Meshfer, Harav Chaim Pinchas Ben Malka. And I just want to share a very short little personal story with you, just to give you a sense of who he is. He's the Talmud of the famous Reb Chaim Shmulevitz from the Mir Yeshiva, and he is the most edel person you would ever meet. He is a big Talmud Chacham. He's not a practicing rabbi, but he is a huge Torah scholar. You would just love to meet him. And I remember the first time, I got my permission, sorry, just be very short and sweet. I had my first meal at my Shver and Shvigar's as a young man. I hadn't met my wife's family, and I needed sort of license because they're kind of Lithuanian royalty, and I had to get the haskama, you know, the approval of my future mother-in-law and father-in-law. So my mother-in-law already, I guess she was won over before I came over for Shabbos. My father-in-law also, but he was waiting. I'll never forget this. Friday night, Kiddush, Hamotzi. And thank God I knew ahead of time. As a rabbi, you always have something to say up your sleeve, just in case you may be called upon. You can ask Rabbi Friedman or Rabbi Andrews. You're always ready in a public circumstance. So I knew, not that this was like a proba for me, but I was determined, you know, just to be ready. So about three or four moments after we're eating our first piece of challah, my shver, my future father-in-law, Rabbi Clark, turns to me, the big smile, me edel. He says, Reb David, do you have something to share on the parsha this week? So thank God I really had something good to share. I got married, a beautiful son. But I just remember that moment because his face, his expression was, you know, the panim was so beautiful. His eyes, his face, his demeanor. And that really taught me a lot. He really valued learning. And he, you know, he wanted to make sure that his daughter, my wife Rachel, got a guy that knows how to learn a little bit. So Baruch Hashem, that was a really great moment. And again, tonight's shir should be for his refuah, Rabbi Clark. So I'm calling tonight's class. It's on Parshas Vayetze from Shabbat. So you have to forgive me. We're going backwards a day and a half, but it's okay. It is called How Dr. Jekyll Became Mr. Hyde. Dr. Jekyll, of course, in our vernacular would be Yaakov Avinu, Jacob. And Mr. Hyde, of course, the hairy guy, most of the comics and the narrative that we see in the movies, usually Mr. Hyde's a very hairy individual. That would be Aesop. And what is the source for this question? So I think if we analyze the very beginning of Vayetze, when Yaakov Avinu leaves the famous scene at Beit El with the ladder, the Sula Mutzav Arza, the angels going up and down the ladder, very famous beginning to our parsha. He arrives at his mom's former home, Aram Naharaim in Haran, right near Nahor. He arrives to get a wife. And he shows up at the well. And I want to say, this is going to be sort of the question that is open-ended tonight. Hopefully we'll come to a resolution a little bit later. Who exactly shows up at the well? I believe that the behavior of Yaakov, of Jacob at the well, is decidedly different in a very profound way than the behavior that we would associate with Yaakov and Jacob back in the previous parsha, Toldos. So let me just read for you. It's not necessary to screen share yet. Maybe it's not even necessary tonight. But I do have a little Jekyll and Hyde, little cute little clip art that I found embedded in the darkness is Mr. Hyde and there's Dr. Jekyll. So it's kind of cute. So let me just cite the pasuk that describes Jacob meeting his beloved Rachel, Rachel Imenu, by the well. Okay? So it says like this, Vayehi kasher ra'a Yaakov es Rachel, and it was when Jacob saw Rachel, who was a daughter of Laban, brother of his mother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Yaakov stepped forward. He rolled the stone from upon the mouth of the well and watered the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Yaakov, Jacob, kissed Rachel, and he raised his voice and wept. Jacob, Yaakov told Rachel that he was her father's brother, and that he was Rebekah, Rivka's son. Then she, Rachel, Rachel, ran, and she told her father, Laban. Let's just step back for a moment. So Yaakov, Jacob, has been forced into exile, galut. He's been forced there because mom and dad requested it. They commanded him to go get a wife. And of course, Rivka, Rebecca, his mom, had a self-defense purpose to make sure that Esav and Yaakov would not come to blows, that I should lose my sons on the same day. Which, by the way, Chazal said, they actually, in a very strange way, Jacob and Esau did die in the same day. Because if you recall, at the very end of Vayechi, when they come to bury Jacob, Esau's still alive. And he shows up at the Machpelah cave in Hebron to contest the last burial place. And Hushim ben Dan, Dan's deaf son, Hushim, knocks the head off of Esau, killing him at that moment. His head is buried into the Machpelah, and then the sons, the Shvatim, the tribes, bury Jacob. So since Jacob had passed away but was not yet buried, it was almost like a neviut. It was a prophecy from Rebecca that her two sons would die on the same day. It's a very strange little sideline. So let's talk about Yaakov, the Jacob that shows up at the well. In the time of the Chumash, who are the most disreputable people to be found? So generally speaking, I hope no one knows anyone in this profession today, but essentially we're talking about shepherds. The shepherds, the Roei Tzon, were a very low class of people. They were criminal element type, they were ruffians, and these were their positive attributes. They were not the nicest people. And so to start up with them is to risk life and limb. So what does Jacob do? He shows up at the well. There's a humongous stone protecting the water of the well, and a bunch of shepherds lazing around, drinking, and whatever else shepherds like to do in their time off. And Jacob admonishes them. He picks a fight with them. Aren't you guys being paid to work? And if so, why are you so lazy? What's going on? He picks a fight with the lowest class. I mean, it's like walking into a Hell's Angels bar with a bunch of Hell's Angels bikers and just starting up with them over the Harley Davidson, gas emissions thing or something. It'd be interesting. So I see that Anne Rosenberg talks about 70 days that they did like a chanita. She's just questioning whether they died in the same day. So you're right. Jacob predeceases Esau by 70 days, but because he's not buried, he's not technically fully dead, according to one approach in the Gemara. But getting back to this, so he starts up with these ruffians, the bikers, the Hell's Angels guys at the well. And again, this is not Jacob. He's supposed to be the Ishtam Yoshev Olim, right? He's the goody tissues, the pure innocent soul who likes to dwell in the houses of learning. And he's showing up at a well and starts giving Musar. He starts scolding these vicious people. What's going on? These reprobates. So that's, again, it's a little bit, to say the least, out of character for Jacob. And then what happens? He sees the beautiful girl come, his future bride, Rachel, Rachel. And so he goes over, and the Gemara discusses how he pops that stone, this humongous stone, which took the collective strength of all of the shepherds to ensure the integrity of the water supply. And single-handedly, Yaakov pops it off like a champagne cork from the champagne bottle. Boom! A feat of strength to show off to the girl. And then he walks over to Rachel, and he gives her a kiss. And this is such an issue that later on, years later, when they are dressing up Leah and turning the lights out for the subterfuge to trick Yaakov, he questions, how come it's so dark? Ah, they say, who are you, dear cousin Yaakov, to judge us for our morality? We're turning the lights up because, we remember very well, when you come, you you Canaanite people, you like to kiss the girls in public. Where's your tznius? Where's your modesty? So he kisses the girl in public. So again, each of these little events on their own would not maybe be an issue for us, but we're going to take it a little further. Yaakov doesn't seem to be behaving the way Yaakov would have behaved in the previous parsha in Toldos when he's the Ishtam Yosha of Elim. I dare say, I would like to offer that he is behaving in an Esav, in an Esau-like manner. Very strange, right? Esau, you can imagine, showing up at the well. He's fearless. He's not going to worry about some reprobates at the well. He's a bigger reprobate than they are, right? They're gonna be genuflecting and bowing in front of Esav because he is, you know, his fame and his infamy precede him. He's the type of guy who kisses the girl and much more. So it just doesn't seem like it's the Yaakov that we knew. What happened to that Yaakov? But then even more, listen to his words. He says to Rachel, ki achi avuahu, that he is the brother of her father and also a son of Rebecca, of Rivka. Well, he is a son of Rebecca, but since when is he the brother of Lavan? Again, you can go back to the story in Mitzrayim when Abraham tells Paro, right, or Paro's men, that he and Sarah are like sisters. So you could say that, you know, that area of the world, they used to call each other loosely, hey, brother, hey, sister. It just meant close family relatives. Or Rashi sees that as something much more. Rashi says the following. It's beautiful. Why the redundancy? Why does he have to identify himself in two different ways to Rachel, both as brother of Lavan, her dad, and also as the son of Rivka? Now remember, Rebecca would have been the aunt of Rachel, right? So they're mishpacha, they're all family. Why both? So he's saying to Rachel the following. Look, if your dear old dad is Lavan ha'arami, if he's Lavan the deceiver, the con artist, then I will school him in the art of the con. But if he acts as an ish emes, as a righteous, upright, truthful person with me, remember, I'm also a son of Rebecca, who is mishonesty, misintegrity. So either way, I'm prepared. I'm prepared for chicanery, and I'm prepared for integrity and honesty. But we have an issue here. What kind of boast is this? Ki achi avuahu? Really, Jacob? You are the brother of the master of the dark side, Lavan, in nefarious chicanery. Is this a true statement? I mean, minimally, one could argue that it is an exaggeration of epic proportions, and perhaps it's an outright lie. But it can't be, right? Because remember, what's the defining midah? What attribute defines Jacob? Emes. Yaakov, emes. Udvarcha, emes. Or as we say in Uvalat Zion, right? The Hashem titain emet li Yaakov. He gave truth to Jacob. He doesn't lie. So we are forced to accept that the quote-unquote boast is not an exaggeration. It's most definitely not a lie. He is saying to Rachel, I am fully prepared to engage your dad. And however your father engages me, I will reciprocate, either through chicanery or through integrity. Either way, I'm ready. How could this be? How can it be that Jacob becomes like the Esau character in his relationships with the shepherds and Rachel, his future wife, and then all of a sudden he's elevated himself to Lavan status when it comes to the dark side. Now, let's just step back for a moment. You don't get a nickname in the Torah unless it's definitive of who you are. So when we call Lavan, Lavan ha'arami, Laban the Aramean, I'm sure in his world, that would actually be something he'd put on his CV, you know? Oh my gosh, God said, I am the consummate cheater in the world. I am the deceiver of all deceivers. So how in the world does Jacob make a statement, a true statement apparently, about his own expertise in the dark side? We know that this is contrary to the nature of who Yaakov was. And again, listen to the description of Yaakov and Esav upon their birth. Okay, this is from Hashem. This is definitive, right? Vayigdalu ha-ne'arim, the lads, or as they would say in a movie called My Cousin Vinny, the youths grew up. Vayihi Esav ish-yade-tzayid ish-sadeh. And Esav was a man who knew hunting, a man of the field. The Yaakov and Jacob, ish-tam yoshev ohalim. He was a wholesome man, dwelling in tents of learning. And Rashi says famously, why would it have to say about Esav that he was the yodeat tzayid, the man who knew how to hunt? Look, if you're a hunter, just say he's a hunter. What do you mean? Like, in other words, you would never say Derek Jeter, yodea baseball. He knows about baseball. He's a baseball player. He's a hunter. Finished. Yodea seems to imply that in addition to the basic skills of hunting in a conventional way, clearly the word yodea that he knows about it is more cerebral. And so therefore Rashi comes from this with a question about why does it say the word yodea? And he answers, it's all about Ramaus again. It's about deception because he knew how to ensnare and deceive his dad, Yitzchak, Isaac. And what about the Ishtam? Listen to Rashi. What does it mean, Ishtam, to be wholesome? Eino baki b'chol eila. He is not expert, says God, about Jacob, in any of these matters that Esav is expert in, chicanery and deception. Except, rather, elo kilibo kempi. Whatever is in his heart, so is in the mouth of Jacob. And then he goes on to say that a person, Misha eno charif liramos koreitam, whoever is not very charif, who's not sharp in the art of deception, is called a tam, someone who is an innocent, a little wet behind the ears. So again, this is definitive. Not only is Yaakov Mr. MS, he's Mr. Truth. Being a tam means that pumfraker, it's the opposite of Esav. He doesn't have bikias, any expertise in the dark arts. This is who Jacob is. So let's back up for a moment. How could it be that Jacob, the Ishtam, the man who is the wholesome tent dweller, inexpert in anything in the dark arts, how can he then, in one parsha, show up at the well with Rachel and truthfully say that he is the brother of Laban? He's going to take Laban to school. Depending on how Laban behaves towards him, he will reciprocate in kind, whether goodness or with chicanery. How can that be a statement? Now, just to clarify again with Laban, if any of you are experts in the difference between Ramaut, a con artist, versus just someone who is a gana, let me just illustrate that to you. I think it's kind of fun. So a couple of parshas ago, we had the story in Chayisara of Avraham Avinu having to deal with this very nefarious character. His name was Ephron Hachiti, Ephron the Hittite. So I would recommend highly that if you're in a business deal and the guy signs his name as a Hittite, you probably want to count your shekels before you go into the deal. So Ephron the Hittite doesn't make any pretense that his chicanery is for your benefit. In one verse, in one pasuk, literally, without exaggeration, he says to Avraham Avinu, to Abraham, oh, you want the field, the cave, the Marasa Machpelah? Nesi Elokim Atoy Madi. Come on. I'm going to charge you, the Prince of God? It's free. Just ask, and it shall be done. And then Abraham responds, no. This is personal. I'm not coming to you as the Prince of God. I'm coming to you as a husband who wants to acquire a burial place for his wife. No more and no less. And the next pasuk, what does Ephron say, basically? Oh, so this is not about you as the Prince of God? Oh, okay. you know, our bameo shekel kesef, beiniu vein chol mahi. You know, what's a couple million shekels between friends? So think about this. You go from free, and then a pasuk, a verse later, what's a couple million dollars? Because the centurion coins, and I did the arithmetic once, I don't remember the exact value of the silver, today's exchange rate, but those over la socher, they were special coins called centurion shekels that were unique. And 400 of those coins had a value over $1 million in today's currency. So he's basically going from free, yeah, no strings attached, to what's a million or $2 between friends. So Ephron the Hittite is just an out and route. He's a ganav. He's a thief, right? He's the guy at the perpetually going out of business electronics shops in New York, Ephron and Sons, you know, where you go in and the MSRP on the camcorder you want to buy is $999 and it's crossed out. I was once there as a younger yeshiva guy. And then you want to get a camcorder, so it has $999 crossed out. Then it has $699 crossed out. Then it has $499 crossed out. Luckily, I knew that the MSRP was $199. So Ephron had, you know, $299 written in big mitzia today, just for you, young Jew. And you know, of course, that the mitzia is still $100 over what the manufacturer suggested retail price is. So that's the Ephron of the world. He doesn't make a pretense, or not a legitimate effort, to try to say, well, it's for your benefit. You're such a pal, right? But what about the Lavan of the world? What is he? He's a decidedly different animal. You see, Lavan is a con man. He's a Ramay. Ramaus is a presentation of his reality to you. So any of you who maybe have seen any of the David Mamet movies over the years, he's this Jewish guy who makes these amazing character studies of con artists and the con itself. What a con artist brings to the table is something very unique. A con artist doesn't try to sell you an item overtly. No. You know what he does? He essentially acquires your confidence through a relationship. And through that relationship comes the con at the end. And if he's really slick and really good, you know, you'll go out there with a big smile on your face thinking you made the greatest acquisition in history. How wonderful it is that Mr. Madoff just let you in on this 40% per month, you know, great property in Tahiti that he's let you in on this deal. So you go home already cheshbonning out, calculating how much money you're going to make for your retirement, and Bernie Madoff is off to the next guy. He's already made off. By the way, could you think of a better name for a guy who's a con artist? He made off with, okay, I'm sorry, couldn't resist that one. So Bernie Madoff is one of our own, but maybe has some little, you know, or a lot of Lavan in him. The Lavans of the world, they're con artists. And what a Ramay tries to do is he's already calculated 100 steps, 100 moves ahead of you. So it just isn't possible for a normal human being, not schooled in the dark arts, to try to outthink the con artist and outcon the con. You're going to lose. It's just impossible. And to think that the Ishtam Yoshev Olim, that Yaakov Avinu, that Jacob in one parsha can make this transformative shift to become somehow someone he's not and succeed, as he tells Rachel, I will win the day against Dad if Dad acts as the Ramay, it just seems disingenuous. How do we reconcile this? So I'd like to share an approach with you. And the approach is based on the missing 14 years of Jacob's life. So Rashi is a big cheshbon a little later, and he tries to calculate the age of Jacob when the Shvatim, when the tribes are born. And he is missing 14 years, because we know how old the twins were. They were 15 years old, according to the Midrash, when the Haliteni Na Min Adam Adam Azeh, the sale of the lentils, or I like to say the Gishmak Cholent, that Jacob sells for the Bechorah, for the birthright. We know exactly what day that was, because it was the death of Avram Avinu. Abraham died 5 years prematurely to spare him from the embarrassment and shame of seeing Esau publicly announced as a Rasha, as a wicked human being. He murdered his first human being that day. The twins are 15 years old, and we know that they were 63 at the point where he goes and dresses up like his brother. And therefore, he's 77 years old when he shows up at the well and the story of Rachel. So what happened between 63 and 77? He is asked to leave, more specifically, commanded by dad and mom to get out of Dodge. He almost gets murdered on the way by his own nephew, Eliphaz, who is sent by Esau to murder him. He talks his way out of that, losing all his wealth that he had brought for a dowry and for gifts for his new wife. But he shows up at the well, what, 14 years later? Well, you say, well, wait a minute, Rabbi, there's this famous story of the angels going up and down. Maybe he aged or something during this 14 years. No. So what does Rashi say? You know what Rashi famously says? I'll quote him. He says that at the point of the dream, he lies down at that place, the future Makam HaMikdash, the place where the temple is going to be, the actual Kodshi Kodshim, the Holy of Holies, and he sleeps there. Why is that significant that he lay down there? So Rashi says, for 14 years, he never lay down. But in that place, in God's home, the night of the dream of the angels, he sleeps for the first time in 14 years. Where was he for 14 years, Rashi says? He was at the famous yeshiva, the rabbinical seminary of Shem and Efer. Shem, one of the three sons, the antediluvians, Noah's three sons who survived the flood, and a great-grandson, Efer. Apparently, they were Rosh Yeshivas. They set up a beautiful yeshiva, a house of learning. We'll talk about that in a moment. And Jacob, did not immediately go to get a wife. He had a little side stop, just a little one, right? He spent 14 years learning in yeshiva. So we have to really try to understand this, because people love the Midrash, but it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Here's my question for you. Who taught Torah to Yaakov? His grandfather, his Zaidi, someone you know named Avraham Avinu, and his father, Yitzhak Avinu. So let me understand. You have Abraham and Isaac teaching you Torah as your Rebbes, and that's not sufficient. You need to further your Jewish education by going to the Yeshiva Shem and Aver, whatever that might mean. We'll examine that in a moment. Like that, it seems kind of unnecessary. I don't know. Like, what's going on? And exactly what is the Yeshiva Shem and Aver? They're not even Jews. Remember, these are B'nai Noach. They're wonderful people. They're huge tzaddikim. They're righteous people, of course. But they're not Jewish people, because Abraham's the first of the Jew. Right? He's Avram Avri. He's the first of our kind, and Sarah. So before them, no, right? Shem is Melchizedek, in fact. He's the one who gives fame, bestows the famous renown upon Abraham. So we know that they're not Jewish. So not only is it a quote-unquote yeshiva, but it's the Rosh Yeshiva, so to speak, the head of the Talmudic Academy, are not even Jews. So what exactly are they offering in the Yeshiva Shem and Eber that they didn't offer perhaps in the yeshiva of Avraham, of Abraham and Isaac and Yitzchak? It seems kind of strange that he would spend 14 years there, and he was really steiging, right? He was really learning. His head did not even hit the pillow, apparently, in a conventional way for 14 years. He fell asleep over his Artsfil Gemara. So I always ask the question, what Sfarim, what Jewish books do you think were populated the shelves of the yeshiva Shem and Eber? Okay, I know this is going to come as a shock to you, but this actually predates Art Scroll, Rabbi Art Scroll Shlita. So there clearly wasn't any Art Scroll Gemaras. There wasn't an Art Scroll Chumash there. Was no Stone Chumash. What exactly were they learning? So my own Rebbe, Rabbi Weinberg, Aaron Sestrello, said, beautiful analogy. This is like the university of Aristotle. You know, think about it for a moment. You can call it a university, but what would Aristotle, do they have a campus? Did they have tenured professors who were very annoying that you couldn't fire? Like, what is the University of Plato about, or Aristotle? Clearly, very wise people would come, and they would walk around these beautiful grounds, I'm sure, in Athens, and they would philosophize. Right, they come up with beautiful chiddushim, beautiful insights into the world, and they were brilliant, brilliant people, according to the Rambam, according to Maimonides. So this is like the University of Plato or Aristotle, where the yeshiva Shimon Aver wasn't a conventional yeshiva. Well, what did they offer then specifically to Jacob that he needed? So here I think the answer is self-evident. What unique skills, if you want to call them skills, did Shem, son of Noah, and his grandson, Aver, bring to the table that were uniquely theirs and not Abraham's and not Isaac's? I would say they were survival skills. Think about it. These two individuals uniquely survived the Dor HaMabul, the generation of the flood, the most pernicious generation in the history of our world. They were extinguished for their evil. Aver survives the Dor HaPlaga, the generation of the dispersal, the time of Nimrod and the Ur Kasdim and the conformity of the big Migdal, the big Tower of Babylon, that whole project. Aver survived with his soul intact. So these are unique individuals. I would like to offer to you that the yeshiva of Shimon Aver added to the Torah of Abraham and Isaac in a very profound way. It wasn't the Torah of Hashem. It was the Torah of Galus, of exile. And in a very real way, Yaakov's 20 years in Laban's home was the very first Jewish exile. That was Galus. And in order to plant within the genetics of Jacob, who of course becomes Israel in our weekly Parsha coming up by Yishlach, before he can become the father of Yisrael, meaning our great-grandfather, the namesake, he needs to incorporate into his resume, in addition to the Torah of Avraham and Yitzchak, the Torah of Galus, the survival skills that only Shem and Aver uniquely could impart. And I believe that during those 14 years, the transformation of Jacob the Tom, Jacob the Innocent, into twin brother Esau happens. A literal transformation. Let me prove it to you, okay? When Jacob gets the bracha from his dad, whose bracha was it that he got? Isaac says which bracha. When Esau comes after, he says, your brother came, ba'achicha b'mirma, right? Your brother came with duplicitous intent, the mirma, sneakily, the kachas, and what did he take? Birchase cha, your bracha, Esau. Now, a bracha, blessing, is not generic. It is nuanced very specifically to the recipient. So therefore, if I have Esau in mind, and I bestow upon Esau a blessing that is for Esau and Esau's alone, but it's Jacob, oops, then what effect would that bracha have on a Jacob? None at all. Unless what? Unless Dr. Jekyll can somehow incorporate the elements of Mr. Hyde into himself. And Isaac, amazingly, touches on this Nikuda. He hits it right on. Because what does he say to dear Esau? He says, your brother came and took your bracha. And at the point he could have said, I curse him for his deception. What did Isaac say? Gam Baruch Yeh. I bless him. I know it was Jacob and not you, Esau. And I don't curse him. I give him a bracha. It's his now by the daylight, not by deception. What does that mean? So I believe that Isaac at that moment realized if Jacob can pull off the chicanery, then what do I need Esau for? If the goody two shoes Yeshiva Bachar Yaakov, the Ish Tam, can start his evolution to become an accomplished Ish Sadeh, a man of the field, right? Even we use that vernacular today, right? You have your field you choose for your occupation. We call it a field of endeavor. So he's the Ish Sadeh, like Esau. He starts to become Esau at that moment. So when Isaac realizes, much to his shock, oh my gosh, I don't need the partners. I don't need Esav to master this world and support your brother Jacob in the yeshiva. Jacob can do it all. He can be both twins. He can become Esau and accomplish and take care of himself in this world. And he also at the same time can retain the morality and Torah that I have taught him. So therefore, I don't really need Esav in the equation anymore. And of course, he says, Gam Baruch Hiya. Amazing. So what's the takeaway? The only way that Jacob can be Roy, can be deserving of the mantle of Yitzhak alone without Esav's connection, is if he becomes Esav. When I say becomes, he incorporates certain elements of the Yodeit Sayid, of the chicanery, the man who knows how to manipulate and hunt. He has to be able to incorporate those elements in order to survive Lavan. And therefore, when he shows up at Lavan's house, he has been fortified with 14 years of pure Torah Galus, the Torah of the exile, the Torah of Shem and Aver. How do you survive a flood? How do you survive the generation of the dispersal of the Tower of Babylon? So by incorporating the Torah of 14 years and amalgamating it with the Torah of Abraham and Isaac, he becomes a unique individual. He shows up at the well and he behaves like in an Esav way. Hey, shepherds, you're a bunch of lazy good-for-nothings. You're stealing from your master. Get up and do something. Popping the cork, kissing the girl. And here's the best. Who does he marry first? He marries Leah. Who was Leah destined to marry? Esav. That's why she cried every day, because the eldest, born to Isaac and Rebekah, was going to marry the oldest daughter, born to Lavan. Leah was supposed to be the shidduch, the one who was supposed to marry Esav. And in fact, Jacob even makes the comment after he marries Leah and realizes what happened. He's, oh my gosh, if my brother Esav hated me for taking the birthright and the blessing, oh my gosh, when he finds out that I married Leah, his predestined wife, oh my gosh, he's going to really blow a gasket. But how does he marry Leah? How is that a successful union? You know how it's a successful union? Because the union of Leah and Jacob is almost a union of the Esav components that are within Jacob now, that he brought to fruition the latent DNA, if you will, that he got from Rebecca. Remember, Rebecca is Lavan's sister. So there's a lot of genetics and DNA of Ramaut. It was dormant within Jacob's soul, but it was brought out through the yeshiva Shem and Aver, and he marries Leah. Rabbis look at Leah and Rachel. Leah is the vision of the components of Esav. And Rachel, of course, is for Jacob. So together, he becomes Father Israel. So I really believe that this is the gift that Jacob's given to each and every one of us, to understand the mind of Galut, of what it means to live in exile, what it means to live with an Ephron the Hittite, and more specifically, what it means to live in a world of Ramaut, a presentation. Everything's fake. It's all for your benefit. It's all about what I can do for you. I will gain your confidence and then strip you from everything you have. This is what Galus is. How have the Jewish people survived thousands of years in Galus? I believe very specifically, the 14 years in the Yeshiva of Shem and Aver gave us, the progeny of Jacob, the ability to know the mind of the persecutor. Because let's end with this concept. How does a con man pull off the con successfully, right? If he doesn't, he goes to jail. But if he's a really good con artist, he has to be brilliant, because he has to know the mind of the mark, right? It's not enough just to come out with brute force and take the money. No, no, no. You have to swindle him. It has to be pretense, where you have to know the needs and mind of the mark in order to successfully take the money from the mark. So remember we asked the question, how could Jacob brag to Rachel that he would be the brother of her dad and take him to the cleaners? Should he act with him disreputably? How did Jacob do it? You know how he did it? Not just the 14 years of Yeshiva, but what he was taught is you don't have to outthink Lavan, because nobody can outthink Lavan. There's no human being ever who could have one up Lavan in the dark arts of Rama'ut, of deception. But Jacob didn't need to. All he needed to do was hold up the mirror, and he would look at Lavan and say, well, what are Lavan's needs? What does he want? Oh, it's Davar Pasha. It's very simple. You know what he wants? He wants me, because I'm righteous, and benefit him materially. The 30 days that he was there before he makes the arrangement to marry Rachel for 7 years of work, everyone was benefiting from Jacob. All the town was all the stock portfolio, literal stock portfolio, I might add, the cows, the sheep, everybody was being born. There were rainfalls. Everything was a bracha, all attributed to the arrival of Jacob the Tzadi. So when Lavan assembles the town council, he says, you don't want my nephew to leave. He's benefiting us. Come on, let's be part of the chicanery. Let's figure out a plan to keep him here for years. So what did Yaakov understand? He understood that Lavan, my dear future father-in-law, just wants one thing. He wants me to work for him, but he doesn't want to pay me anything. So you remember what Yaakov says? Don't pay me a penny, not a shekel. Just give me Rachel. No money, please. So every time that Yaakov deals with somebody, he knows what he wants. So in this week's parsha, we'll end with this. What does Esau want from him? Esau wants Jacob to take religion from him, to free him from the burden of being the goody-two-shoes follower of Abraham and Isaac. And Esau is more than happy to take that money and run. So all the mincha, the gifts, the hundreds of animals, and the rabbis say that as long as Esau was in his Edom and Har Seir, Jacob would continually bribe him with gifts and presents to keep him happy. So again, Jacob survives Esau's wrath by knowing the mind of the mark, not in a nefarious way, but understanding who he's dealing with. And I believe the Jewish people, we, more than any other people, using our gifts that Jacob has given us, we understand who the bad guys are, and we understand how to deal with the bad guys. If the bad guys are really bad, we send, I don't know if you heard this, but apparently we sent robotic android-like machine guns to Iran to take out the guy who was going to build atomic bomb to kill all of the Jews in Israel. Apparently they're saying now on the Farsi network in Iran, take this for what it is, that it wasn't enough that we sent a team of like 62 undercover assassins into the heart of Iran to take out their head scientist who was guarded like nobody else. He had like three or four different cars and guns and guarded bodyguards. We still managed. Now they're claiming that we invented, like there were no humans involved, that somehow the Israelis invented some satellite controlled RoboCop and we went in there with robotics and took them out. So again, survival skills. And I don't think anyone has ever had greater survival skills from Yaakov to the Mossad, right? The Mossad truly know the mind of the mark. And Baruch Hashem, it's kept us alive and well. Should be for all of us a continued bracha that as the Jewish people, we should continue to understand where we live and what we live. We've lived in the greatest country in the world in exile, in Galut. And with that caveat, b'mhera b'yameinu, very soon we should all be able to be in Jerusalem and Israel, returning to where we really belong.